Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Wednesday, December 27th. Thank you all for tuning in and welcome to our viewers and listeners. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues John Elmer, Tamara Nassar, and Ali Abunima. It's day 82 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Today, Ali will be talking about his new report that he co-wrote with reporter David Sheen on some brand new details about how Israeli forces killed their own civilians in Kibbutz Be'eri on October 7th. And of course, we'll have John with an extensive military analysis and some of the latest videos made by the Palestinian resistance, so stay tuned. But first, a look at some of the news over the last few days. Over the Christmas holiday, Israel continued to heavily bombard areas across the Gaza Strip by land, air, and sea. Video obtained by Al Jazeera showed the immense destruction by Israeli forces of the Sheikh Radwan neighborhood in the northern Gaza Strip. In the middle of Gaza, Israeli forces carried out more than 50 individual strikes on three refugee camps, Al Burej, Nuseirat, and Maghazi camp, where at least 70 people were killed and dozens were injured. Israel also destroyed the roads connecting the camps, which impacted the delivery of relief aid to those in need, according to the United Nations. A resident of Maghazi spoke to our contributor Gada Abed about his search for his loved ones amidst the rubble. Our reporter wrote, quote, "With every step amid the ruins of their home, he sought to find the bodies of his parents, siblings, and their children. The rubble was so heavy that recovering their bodies was impossible." Quote, "I survived," the man said, his voice trembling with grief, "but I don't know where my parents and brothers are." Another resident said, quote, "We will always remember this night, December 24th. It is the bloodiest in Maghazi since the war began." You can read more by Gada Abed on the massacre in Maghazi on electronicintifada.net. On Christmas Day in Gaza, Israeli media published a video reportedly showing Israeli forces detaining hundreds of Palestinians inside Al Yarmouk football stadium in Gaza City, according to the UN. The videos show the detainees, including children, older people, and persons with disabilities, being forced to strip to their underwear in degrading conditions, the UN said. The Geneva-based EuroMed Human Rights Monitor submitted a primary report to UN officials and the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court on Monday, documenting, quote, dozens of cases of field executions carried out by the Israeli army in the Gaza Strip. The human rights group said, quote, that they requested an immediate investigation into these crimes, calling for the perpetrators to be held accountable and for justice for all victims. Here is one such video testimony filmed by Al Jazeera of a man witnessing a summary execution of his brother in front of his mother in Jabalia camp.
"I am a UN staff. Unfortunately, they don't have mercy on the UN staff or any international organization staff. I live in this apartment with my family. The sniper went there and the tanks came to this area. I told them in Hebrew that we are only civilians in this building, but they shot us. My son, my niece, and a third one, I kept telling them we need to be treated, but no way. They continued their shooting. They broke the gates and they brought us down. They told us to take our clothes off and then told us to come to this area. I told them there were some injured people here, but they didn't care. They asked me if I'm a UN staff. I told them yes. They took me with them and interrogated me four times. They accused me of being a member of Hamas, and I'm not. They asked me where I was on October 7th. I said I was at home, preparing myself to go to my school. They left the children bleeding for more than an hour. They told me that the resistance fighters used to shoot from our house. And of course, that is not true at all. They killed my brother in front of my mother. They shot him from under his chin, hitting his entire skull. They didn't allow me to say goodbye to my dead brother. They kept asking me if I'm a Hamas member. I told them, no, I'm not. I blame the UN because the UN staff have no protection. The Israeli forces burnt my house. Why did they do that? I'm not a resistance fighter. Finally, they gave us a paper that says we are okay and that we didn't do anything wrong. We were humiliated. My brother was killed. my children wounded for no reason. What's our fault? What's the fault of the civilians?
On Tuesday, video testimonies by Palestinian detainees who had been taken to Israel and then reportedly released back into Gaza through the Kerem Shalom crossing were released to the media. The UN said that, quote, detainees, including older persons, alleged that they had been tortured and ill-treated in captivity, with video footage showing bruises and burns on their bodies. They also reported being deprived of food, water, and access to toilets and being exposed to the elements. Meanwhile, top Israeli lawmakers are openly advocating that Palestinians be, quote, voluntarily migrated from Gaza. The Electronic Intifada's senior editor Maureen Murphy reported that Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had, quote, told lawmakers from his Likud party in recent days that he is pushing for the voluntary migration of Palestinians in Gaza. He said that the challenge was finding, quote, countries that are willing to absorb them, and we are working on it. Maureen writes that, quote, voluntary migration is euphemistic language for a coerced mass expulsion of Palestinians from Gaza, a proposal made by senior Israeli politicians such as Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich throughout the war. Removing Palestinians from their homeland so that they may be replaced by foreign Jewish settlers has always been the single organizing principle of the State of Israel. Israel's military operations in Gaza, which have rendered the territory unsuitable for sustaining human life by destroying housing, medical facilities, and other essential infrastructure, appear to be aimed at forcing an expulsion on that same scale or even greater, Maureen reports. Israel's evacuation orders are pushing Gaza's population of 2.3 million Palestinians to an increasingly narrow coastal area near the Egyptian border. That was from our senior editor Maureen Murphy's new piece, Netanyahu Boasts of Voluntary Migration as Horrors Are Revealed in Gaza's North, up now on electronicintifada.net. And finally, in the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed two Palestinians, including a 17-year-old child, Ahmad Mohammed Yusuf Yagi, and injured two others, shooting them with live ammunition during a raid into the Al-Fawar refugee camp in Hebron on Tuesday. Since October 7th, 295 Palestinians, including 77 children, have been killed in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, according to the UN. But we'll now take a look at a new investigation published by the Electronic Intifada about what really happened on October 7th. We reveal how an Israeli general ordered tanks to fire on a house with Israeli civilians in it that day in Kibbutz Be'eri, and then tried to cover the incident up with a fake story of heroism. Now, relatives of those he killed are demanding the truth. That general, Barak Hiram, also appears to have originated one of the most poisonous fabrications Israel told about October 7th, the atrocity tale that Hamas fighters tied up and executed children in cold blood. That lie, told directly to President Biden by Benjamin Netanyahu, helped lay the ground for genocide. Ali, you wrote this piece with investigative journalist David Sheen that sheds more light on what happened on October 7th, particularly how Israel killed many of its own people on that day. Walk us through these new revelations.
Thanks, Nora. Yes, as you know, this is a story we've been on since the very first day, and it's a central part of what happened on October 7th that mainstream media continue to pretend not to see. But important new pieces of information have come out in Israeli media over the last week or 2 weeks that really add to what we know.
And there's both new video evidence and new testimony. Is that right?
Yes. First, in terms of the video, just last week, Israel's Channel 12 released a video shot from an Israeli military helicopter on October 7th over Kibbutz Be'eri. That's one of the Israeli colonial settlements just a few miles east of Gaza. And we can actually take a look at that now. And this is was published on...
Yeah. אנחנו מקבלים הזדמנות נדירה לראות מלמעלה את הטרגדיה של קיבוץ בערי, כפי שהכוחות ותושבי הקיבוץ ראו אותה בזמן אמת. בשעה 4:20 אחר הצהריים, יותר מ-9 שעות אחרי שחדרו לבערי מאות מחבלים, שכונות שלמות בקיבוץ עולות באש.
אני צופה עכשיו על בערי, על החלק הצפוני. אני רואה מוקד אשן בחלק הצפוני מערבי, מול הבית אלמין. שם זה הקרקלים הסופים?
התיעוד הזה חושף בפנינו את היקף הלחימה ומספר המחבלים הבלתי נתפס שהשתלטו על הקיבוץ. הוא תיעד את הטנק שסייע לכוחות בבית של פסי וירה פגזים לעבר הבית.
והם הביאו פתאום טנק. אני אומרת לאחד החיילים, תגיד, אבל אם אתם אומרים פגזים זה לא יפגע בבני הערובה? אז הוא אומר לי, לא, אנחנו רק עושים את זה בצדדים, להוריד קירות.
הוא מעצים את סימני השאלה בהתנהלות צהל והימם מול בית עם 15 בני ערובה.
בא לראות טנק בתוך בערי.
So what you see there, there's a lot of smoke rising. We'll keep running the video while I speak from houses in the kibbutz. But now for the first time, you actually saw the flashes in the video. You see an Israeli tank rolling through the streets of the kibbutz and actually firing a shell into one of the houses. And the woman you see there, speaking briefly, is Yasmin Porat, and I think a lot of people will remember that name. I'll come back to Yasmin in a minute. But what I want to emphasize here is that what we know is this was not the only tank used in Kibbutz Be'eri on October 7th, and this was not the only shot fired. It's just the only shot that so far we've seen on video. As David Sheen and I write in our article, another tank showed up a short time later and fired towards that particular house, killing a number of the Israeli civilians there, along with all the Palestinians, or almost all of them, including the partner of Yasmin Porat and a little Israeli girl called Liel Hatzroni, and the husband of an Israeli woman called Dagan. There were, in fact, 15 captives at that house, along with several dozen Palestinian fighters, and all 15 of the Israeli captives were killed except for Hadas Dagan and Yasmin Porat. Now, we already knew a lot of this from Yasmin Porat's early interview on Israeli state radio back on October 15th, which went viral after the Electronic Intifada translated it. Porat told about how the Palestinians holding the Israelis there had treated them really humanely and assured them that they would be safe. And you can see her again in this little clip talking about her immediate fears and doubts when she saw Israeli forces rolling up with a tank right outside the house where her own partner and the other civilians were. But it was indeed the Israeli forces who showed up and started firing heavily and who ended up killing everyone there, according to Yasmin Porat.
Right. And now Hadas Dagan has spoken out herself.
That's right. Earlier this month, she gave her first interview to Israeli television, along with relatives of some of the other Israelis who were killed at that house when the Israeli tanks opened fire. So here's just a short clip of Hadas Dagan speaking to Israel's Channel 12, and this was on December 9th.
נוראי ואני לא מצליחה להזיז את הרגליים. היה לי ברור שיש פה טנק. זה היה ברור לי לגמרי. אני נפגעתי ועדי מהרסיס של הפגז של הטנק. זה היה ממש באותו רגע.
Yeah. And there you see that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, we've also learned more about the Israeli officer who ordered that particular tank shelling. He's Brigadier General Barak Hiram. What did you and David Sheen find out about him?
Yeah, General Barak Hiram is a fairly senior Israeli military officer. He's held a number of prestigious commands and has in fact been named as the next commander of the Gaza Division. That's the same Israeli division that was supposed to guard the perimeter around Gaza, but which was virtually destroyed and simply collapsed when attacked by the Palestinian resistance on October 7th. And Barak Hiram has tried to portray what happened in Kibbutz Be'eri in a completely different and false manner, covering up how his order killed Israelis. And of course, he's tried to portray himself in a heroic manner. He portrays himself as having just rushed to the scene and taken charge and basically saved the day. And he made these claims in an interview with Ilana Dayan, one of Israel's top investigative journalists. And here's Hiram speaking to Dayan. And this was in an interview broadcast on Israel's Channel 12 on October 26th. Let's take a look.
מדווחים על אירוע בני ערובה בבארי. בפועל, למרבה הצער, לא היו בני ערובה.
בשלב הזה גם יש כוח של ימם שהכנסנו פנימה ליישוב, ותוך כדי שהוא מתאר את השכונה שהוא קיבל, אחת האזרחיות מצליחה לברוח מהמבנים, ונוצרת איזושהי דינמיקה או תחושה שהמחבלים שמתבצרים שם בתוך הבלוק מוכנים אולי לדבר או משהו כזה.
לנהל מסע ומתן.
לכאורה. ואפילו מגיע צוות מום מתקלי שמנסה ליצור איתם קשר ולקרוז.
אמונים?
אמונים לנו בטיל RPG.
ובשלב
הזה אני מאשר למפקד הכוח של הימם שהיה שם לפרוץ פנימה ו... לנסות להציל את האזרחים שכלואים בתוך אותם מבנים.
זאת אומרת, כשהכוח של הימה מנהל שם באמת קרב גבורה ומסתער פנימה, עוד יש איזושהי תקווה שאולי יש בני ערובה שאפשר לחלץ?
אני חושב שבבלוק הזה היו כ-20 אזרחים, ואני חושב שכוח הימה מצליח להציל את 4 מהם.
כל היתר נרצחו.
כל היתר נרצחו בדם קר.
כמה מחבלים שמה... בדעתך היו רק במתחם הזה?
בספירת הגופות הגענו ל-26 מחבלים.
רק במתחם
רק
הזה?
רק במתחם הזה. ושם מצאנו 8 ילדים כפותים ביחד ואירועים. זוג של בעל ואישה כפותים ביחד ואירועים.
Let's run that again without the sound if we can. I'd like to just summarize the points he made, because there may be people listening. And so, as you can see here, he's talking to Ilana Dayan, and she's kind of walking him through. She says there were no hostages. And he talks about what happened, that the commandos were on the scene, that they brought into Kibbutz Be'eri, and while purifying the neighborhood, that's the term they use for their violence, one of the citizens manages to flee. Now, that's a reference to Yasmin Porat, actually leaving under negotiations. And he gives the impression that negotiations were impossible, and he gives the order to the commandos to rush in and save the day. So on his order, after the negotiations fail and the terrorists, as he calls them, respond with an RPG, he authorizes the commandos, the Yamam, to burst inside and to try to save the citizens trapped in those buildings. And then the Yamam wage a truly heroic battle, according to Ilana Dayan, and charge inside. And he claims that there were about 20 citizens inside. There were, in fact, 15. And he claims the commandos saved 4 of them. And then Ilana Dayan says all the rest were murdered in cold blood. And then Barak Hiram goes into these details where he claims we found 8 children tied together and shot, and a couple, a husband and wife, tied together and shot. And then Ilana Dayan asserts that there were no actual hostages because everyone had been murdered. So now, there are a couple of outrageously false statements that David Sheen and I detail in the article. First, there were, in fact, extensive negotiations with the Palestinians inside, and that had led to the surrender of one of the Palestinian commanders along with Yasmin Porat. And there was another officer on the scene who was arguing with Hiram that force should not be used at that point anyway, and that negotiations should continue, because as we had seen, Yasmin Porat and this Palestinian had come out due to the negotiations. The second outrageous lie is that the Yamam, the Israeli commando force, went into the house to rescue hostages and in fact rescued four people. This is pure fiction. There was no rescue attempt by the commandos, and it was Barak Hiram's order to fire that ensured that everyone still alive among the captives was killed, except for Hadas Dagan. So that is a complete fabrication. There was no rescue attempt. He made that up. But perhaps the most consequential lie is Hiram's claim that the captives were tied up and executed in cold blood. This is a pure fabrication. As we detail in our article, this did not happen in this incident, and there's no evidence that it happened anywhere else.
And why do you say that this is the most consequential lie? There's so many. Why is this the most consequential one?
Well, David Sheen and I believe that Barak Hiram's story that he started telling very early on, before this interview with Ilana Dayan, is the origin of one of the major lies that Israel has been telling about October 7th. It's a fabricated atrocity tale that Israel used and is still using to justify and incite genocide. A lot of people believe this. And here's Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking on October 9th. So this is very early on. Let's take a look.
The savage attacks that Hamas perpetrated against innocent Israelis are mind-boggling. Slaughtering families in their homes, massacring hundreds of young people at an outdoor festival, kidnapping scores of women, children, and elderly, even Holocaust survivors. Hamas terrorists bound, burned, and executed children. They are savages.
Yeah, and then now here's another clip. This is from October 11th, and it's a clip of Netanyahu speaking to President Joe on the phone.
Joe, I want to give you a clear picture of the difficult situation we face. We were struck Saturday by an attack whose savagery I can say we have not seen since the Holocaust. I mean, we had hundreds massacred, families wiped out in their beds in their homes, women brutally raped and murdered, over 100 kidnapped, including children. And since we last spoke, the extent of this evil, it's only gotten worse. They took dozens of children, bound them up, burned them, and executed them.
And look, here is Netanyahu writing on Twitter on Christmas Eve, so just a few days ago. And he says there in his tweet, we're facing monsters who murdered children in front of their parents and parents in front of their children, who raped and beheaded women, who burned babies alive, who took babies hostage. As you can see, he repeats a whole series of genocidal lies. This didn't happen. They didn't tie babies up. They didn't rape and behead women. We did a segment a couple of weeks ago on the mass rape claims and the total absence of any credible evidence of that. So there's no claiming that Netanyahu was just going off confused reports or the so-called fog of war in the early days on and after October 7th. His latest statements show that this is a deliberate campaign of lies, of incitement to genocide. And right there under his tweet that we just showed, you could see that other users of X or Twitter were posting notes pointing out that these are lies. So that's just one of the ways that people can try to point out the truth. Of course, that pales next to the kind of megaphone and platform Netanyahu has, and even more so President Biden, who has been repeating these lies constantly. The difference, I think, between Netanyahu and Biden is that Netanyahu knows he is lying, while Biden probably believes these lies. Of course, that's not an excuse. I think it's just the reality of the severely degraded capacities of the so-called leadership in the White House.
Yeah. What about any fallout over this inside Israel? What can you tell us about that?
Yes, as I said, relatives of the Israelis who were killed by General Barak Hiram are demanding an investigation. They were interviewed by Channel 12 and publicly called for an investigation. They said, we don't know what happened here. We don't know why our loved ones were killed, who gave the order to open fire, and so on. But there really has been a closing of the ranks within the Israeli leadership. There was a big story about Kibbutz Be'eri just a couple of days ago. This was on December 22nd. And it's mostly a whitewash, which is what you'd expect from the New York Times. But it does mention in passing that the tank shell ordered to be fired by Barak Hiram killed the husband of Hadas Dagan. And as you can see there, that's David Sheen and I wrote a whole article about this. The New York Times managed a few sentences about what is really the most telling part of this whole episode in Kibbutz Be'eri. And that New York Times report, whitewashed though it is, prompted some criticism in Israel. But we've seen major figures, including former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett and even Israel's military spokesperson, John Conricus, have come out to publicly back Barak Hiram. So he has a lot of support to cover up this crime. And it's doubtful that there'll be any real accountability within Israel, at least for the foreseeable future.
Of course. Excuse me. But Ali, was this tank shelling at Kibbutz Be'eri just an isolated incident? Was it some kind of aberration? Or is there, you know, a bigger story here in terms of Israel killing its own soldiers and civilians on October 7th, knowing about it and of course, covering it up?
Yeah, that's a question a lot of people ask, and they say, oh, well, this is just one little incident. It's still have all these hundreds of people who were killed by Hamas. So this little incident doesn't change the picture. But even in Kibbutz Be'eri, the incident at the house where Yasmin Porat and Hadas Dagan were held, along with all those other people who were killed, is not the whole story. It's a part of the story we now know well because Yasmin Porat and Hadas Dagan lived to tell the tale. But it is not the whole story. As David Sheen and I write, we also know that Israeli forces not only used tanks in Kibbutz Be'eri, but Apache combat helicopters as well. And here's Erez Tidhar, an Israeli rescuer who was in Kibbutz Be'eri that day, describing what he saw there.
Shalom, so we're going to Be'eri. And already at the summit, you see there shivrei mechoniyot and zor krav.
כדי לתאר לך את הסיטואציה, אתה יושב בקיבוץ בתוך מדינת ישראל, שאני מטייל שם בשבתות עם הילדים באופניים. אתה כל דקה יורד עליך טיל, כל דקה. פתאום אתה רואה טיל ממסוק שיורה לתוך הקיבוץ. זאת אומרת, לא הבנתי. מסוק צהלי יורה לתוך קיבוץ ישראלי, ואז אתה רואה טנק נוסע ברחובות הקיבוץ, מצודד את התותח ויורה לפגז לתוך בית.
Yeah, let's if we can, Tamara, let's run that again without the sound. And I'm going to read the subtitles because I know that there are some people who are just listening. And so just so they can read the subtitles, I'm going to read the subtitles of Erez Tidhar, who is the rescuer who was there. Just let it run. Let's let the video run. This is Erez Tidhar, who is there with something called the Etam Rescue and Evacuation Unit. And I'll say more about that in a second. Here we go. He says, you're sitting in a kibbutz inside the State of Israel where I tour on Saturdays with the kids on bikes. every minute a missile comes down on you, every minute, and suddenly you see a missile from a helicopter that fires into the kibbutz, you say to yourself, I don't get it. An IDF helicopter firing into an Israeli kibbutz, then you see a tank driving through the streets and firing a shell into the house. These are things you cannot comprehend. So then let's take a look at this photo from Kibbutz Be'eri. This is a photo from a news agency that we purchased the license to publish at the Electronic Intifada. And look at this. There's obviously no way Palestinian fighters could have caused such total destruction with the light weapons they had, AK-47 assault rifles and a few RPGs.
Right. What about in other places aside from Kibbutz Be'eri?
Right. Well, we know this was the story across the region on October 7th. Let me remind you that in November, an Israeli police source admitted that military helicopters shot at civilians at the Supernova rave, the desert dance party near Kibbutz Be'eri that Yasmin Porat and her partner had attended. And Nof Erez, an Israeli Air Force colonel, has even gone as far as to call the Israeli response to October 7th a mass Hannibal. That's an application on a wide scale of Israel's so-called Hannibal Directive, a military doctrine that allows the deliberate killing of Israel's own people rather than permitting them to be taken captive. And that same month, Israel revealed that hundreds of unrecognizably burned bodies it thought were its own civilians were actually Hamas fighters, a clear admission of indiscriminate fire from helicopters on a massive scale. And earlier this month, the Israeli military admitted to immense quantities of so-called friendly fire incidents on October 7th, but asserted that it would not be morally sound to investigate them, as the Israeli newspaper Yediot Ahronot reported. Mm-hmm. Moreover, Israel has faced huge international embarrassment and anger at home after its army admitted to killing three Israeli prisoners who had managed to get away from their captors in Gaza. We have links to all of these other stories in the piece that David Sheen and I wrote. The key thing here is that the truth has been coming out really in bits and pieces, but unless there is a full independent inquiry, we probably will not get the full picture, but we at the Electronic Intifada will continue to pursue the story as far as we can.
Absolutely. And yeah, I encourage all of our viewers and listeners to go to the Electronic Intifada and read the piece that you and David wrote, Israeli General Killed Israelis on 7 October, Then Lied About It. It was published on Christmas Eve, December 24th. So yeah, encourage everyone to read it. And there are much more details and I think all of the videos and evidence that we just saw here are also embedded in that piece. Thank you, Ali. And before we go to John with the Jelly Bean segment, I know that you had an important announcement about supporting EI and our writers in Gaza.
Thanks, Dora. And I'll just say, I came into the office this morning and I found these jelly beans. I really don't know where they came from. But let me take this opportunity to once again thank all our viewers and supporters. It's really overwhelming. Some of you know that I am making it through my email and I'm reading everything and I am replying to everything. It's just taking me time. And it's wonderful to read all the messages of support, and I'm sharing them with some of them with all my colleagues. And I want to take the opportunity also, you know me and you know Nora and you know John and you know Asa from this live stream. Asa is traveling today, but I also want to shout out my thanks and appreciation for our other colleagues at the Electronic Intifada: Michael Brown, Leah Caldwell, Omar Kermi, Maureen Murphy, Asa, of course, and Tamara Nassar, who does so many things, including making this live stream work as smoothly and as proficiently as it does. And Tamara, maybe we can put the website up. And again, this is a reminder for all of you who already know the Electronic Intifada, but for those who are just joining this live stream and learning about us for the first time, we want you to know that we are an online publication that's been around for 20 years. We publish news analysis about Palestine that you won't get anywhere else. We are completely independent, nonprofit. We are supported by you, readers and viewers like you. And since the start of this genocide in Gaza, we have been publishing way more than we usually do, particularly from our writers in Gaza. And one of the people who works closely with them, who I didn't mention earlier, but of course is very much part of the team, is David Cronin. You also know him as a writer, and David is one of our very fine editors. And you can see right there the amazing articles, the reportage from the ground in Gaza that we are publishing. There was the piece from Ghada Abed that Nora mentioned at the beginning, the horrifying massacre in Merazi camp. And we're very concerned about our friends and colleagues in Merazi. We have several of them there. We heard from two of them this morning letting us know that they were okay, but that the situation there is absolutely horrific. Yeah. All of this, again, as I say, is done with your support. December, I have to say, the thing I like to do is to spend time reporting, writing, reading, editing. But every December, we raise most of the funds that we use in the upcoming year to do our reportage. And this year, it's particularly important because of the amount of extra work we're doing, the amount of extra writing we're publishing from Gaza, and we do pay all our writers in Gaza to make sure that they have the support they need. So if you can, please do make a donation. Now, you can go to the website and hit donate now. The other thing is we write in the description to this video, right down below, there are links to two different donation portals. One, you can use credit card or PayPal. That's a network for good. The other, you can use credit card, Apple Pay, or you can make a donation directly from a U.S. bank account. Of course, donations are welcome from anywhere, and they are tax deductible for people in the United States. And so, again, thank you so much. I should say also, we did announce a matching challenge a couple of weeks ago. We met the match, and we're so grateful to everyone who donated. But we're not done. We still do need to raise some funds to make sure that we have the resources we need to keep doing this work in the coming year. And the other ways you can support us, of course, click on that Get Updates link and sign up for our newsletter so that you can evade social media censorship. And please share our articles, share the videos, let people know about what we do. This is one of the ways we can answer the call of our friends and colleagues in Gaza to keep talking about Gaza, to keep informing the world. And one thing I want to say again, that we are so grateful and humbled by the support we get. And I want to say, if you can make a donation, please do. But if it's going to cause you hardship, if it means you or someone in your family is going to go without something you need, please don't. Support us in the other ways. But if you have extra money, you can make a little bit of an extra donation on behalf of those who can't, because all of this work is free for everyone. It's for the whole world. That's why we do it. And we do it with your support. I went on a little bit long, Nora, but I just wanted to make sure that we really say thank you to everyone who has already shown their support for us, and we want to. Oh, one thing I will say, I have in my notes to add, is you can, on either of those two links that are in the description, set up a monthly donation if you want to. It's a way to sustain us over the year, and that also helps a great deal. And thanks to everyone who's already done so. We love you, and we can't do this without you.
Indeed. Thank you so much. And with that, John, I know that the resistance is hand-delivering pancakes, we've said in the past, pancakes on top of jelly beans. Walk us through the latest resistance jelly bean videos.
Okay, guys, we've got a lot of them for today, so
buckle up. We've been busy.
So this first video is from Gaza City, and we see a fighter carrying what is called a shawaz. He's hand carrying this explosive, and you can see on the right hand side there, you can see the Merkava tank in the neighborhood. And again, this is something that the soldiers don't get out of the tanks ever.
So they don't see him coming.
So they don't see him coming yet. They see him right now. We've cut the video in an effort to not be censored, but you can see him lying down on the ground there, placing the explosive charge. The tank moves forward, it explodes, and he gets out of the way. For people asking, there's a freeze frame of him there. You can see him getting out of the way. The unbelievable courage, I don't know how many times we want to loop this. I think as many as we can, because it's just, it's a really remarkable snapshot into the, both the qualitative advances of the resistance. This Shawaz device is an explosively formed penetrator, which I'll describe to you in a moment, but it's a type of weapon that has come out since the ceasefire, since the pause. As Israeli positions become more fixed, the resistance is able to use different weaponry than they used in the first half of the war to target in different ways the Israeli forces that are inside the Gaza Strip. And this is from this weekend, a weekend that the Israeli military said was its most difficult weekend of the ground war, which is now 55 days on. And so I think we're getting from these videos an idea, and we will from the ones that follow, an idea why it was the toughest for the Israelis. So again, he's getting in position. What we don't hear with the sound is that they see him in the tank coming at the last moment, and they poke out of their porthole and fire a shot at him, which he avoids while putting the blast in the back corner of the tread, which is to disable the tank from moving. But then he's pointed this explosively formed penetrator towards the door, the back door of the Merkava tank, which is the weakest spot on the tank. And so I have a clip here of an American Delta Force soldier from Iraq who takes less than 1 minute to explain what an explosively formed penetrator, an EFP bomb, is. But in short, it's instead of exploding out in all directions, it explodes in a direction. So when he's aiming that explosive at the back door of the tank, it's firing directly at the door. Sorry, I talked over that for you there, Tamara. Do you want to start? Can we start that one again?
Do you want to explain what an EFP does?
Yeah, explosive form projectile. Yeah, it's a hot metal. It's a copper plate. And then that gets pushed with the explosives behind it. And it's packaged in a cylindrical tube or container. And so you have this conical shaped copper and explosives behind it. It's primed from the rear. And then when it shoots out, it envelops on itself and then forms a hot metal copper projectile. And it rips through everything. There's nothing that can stop that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Any armor at the time that anybody was using, it wasn't stopped. It was going right through that stuff. And usually, by the time it triggered on the front of the vehicle, if it was, and they were trying that at the time, they were trying timers, command detonated stuff, and then trips on passive infrared or red. You break a beam and it goes off.
Right, so those are the various different ways that you can detonate. We've seen the Palestinians use that Shawaz device to rig them up for booby traps inside a house, and then to detonate them remotely. That fighter that we just saw in that video is remotely detonating that. And you can do it with very basic. They can do it with cell phones. They can do it with they've been calling. The Palestinians have been calling them television bombs because they're remotely detonated using like a channel changer. It's a very
I wondered what they meant by a television bombs. I guess that explains it then.
Yeah, there's no translation for it. But yeah, so that's a weapon that has been introduced in the second half of this war. And when we see what that Delta Force soldier, he's talking about that from Iraq. They were introduced in Iraq in a sort of a large scale manner, but very the Palestinian resistance, of course, has reverse engineered and really perfected these weapons. So when you see a bomb go off, people saw on that previous clip, the tank pulls forward, which might look like the tank is getting away from the main part of that explosion. But as that Delta Force soldier described, it's actually doing the opposite. It's giving room for that explosively formed projectile to aim itself at the door of the tank, inside which are the crew. And so we saw the Israelis admit to the most deadly weekend. They lost 25 soldiers this weekend. They usually just say in the north or in Khan Yunis, but they don't tell us where these soldiers were killed. But you can imagine that at least a few of them were there, because all that has to happen with an armored vehicle is for it to pierce. You don't have to explode the entire vehicle for it to be deadly, because it pierces the armor, and any piece that pierces the armor becomes a hot piece of metal that's flying around inside what is effectively a bathtub that the soldiers are sitting in that protects them from explosions underneath the tank. So if it's pierced above that, we're looking for sure at serious casualties from that. And that to deliver that bomb by hand, I think social media kind of was very impressed by that. And when you juxtapose that with the footage that we saw coming out the other day from the president of Israel, President Herzog was shown on the Gaza border using a Sharpie marker and writing messages on 155 millimeter shells that are then fired into Gaza, killing, as we know, more than 20,000 civilians have been killed at this point. The juxtaposition between this guy hand placing this device in the most vulnerable spot, he could have put that anywhere. He could have put it on the side and turned and ran, but he goes up and executes his mission right to the final moment of the mission. He doesn't pull away 2 minutes early, which still would have made an impressive spectacle. He's carrying out his mission. And then, as Abu Obeida, the spokesperson for the Qassam Brigades, has said repeatedly throughout this war, these fighters are returning home to their bases to report on these operations. These are not martyrdom.
John, the factor here that I think the Israelis can't contend with is the bravery, is the courage. Because to be able to, you know, there are weapons that are made that are designed to hit a tank or an armored vehicle from a distance in order to keep the soldiers who are firing those weapons safe. And the defensive systems of the tanks also depend on that distance. I think you were talking about this last time with the trophy system. The trophy system needs that distance in order to function. And it's assumed that nobody is going to get that close to a tank, right? Nobody's going to be that crazy to do that. But the Palestinians are able to defeat these tanks because they're willing to violate that assumption that nobody is going to walk right up to a tank in the middle of a battlefield. And the same, I know we're going to talk about this later, goes for the RPGs, because again, they are doing that from such close range. The one thing I want to say also that I thought about when I saw this picture of Isaac Herzog, the president of Israel, who of course in the West is portrayed as this peace-loving figure, almost the contrast to Benjamin Netanyahu, is I thought about our dear friend Rifat Al-Ar'ir, who in one of his first appearances on our live stream talked about how his only weapon was the Expo marker, the markers he used to highlight and make notes in the books he loved so much. And just look at all the different things you can do with a marker. You can use it to enlighten people, as Rifat did, or you can use it to send a message of death in this most horrific and disgusting way by Isaac Herzog.
And the fact that there's just even no discussion about that, that that's just normal, because the Israelis actually do this all the time. They did it back in 2006 in the war in Lebanon, and they got little kids from northern Israel to write on them, like as part of a school project. It's like, it's totally demented. It's really unbelievable. And so the Shoah's device showed this unbelievable courage. And when you said that it's crazy to get that close to a tank, nobody in the world should know better than the Israelis that the Palestinians get close to their tanks. I lived in Jenin for a number of years and was on the streets with the kids, shout out Badges, who used to climb on top of the tank and attempt to pull the gun off the top of the tank, riding through Jenin on top of the tank. And when I first got there and saw this, and also believed at that time that it was crazy, and he hopped off the tank as the tank drove off, and I said, what are you doing? Like, I don't even know if I said it eloquently. I just said, like, what are you doing? That is insane. And he just looked at me and he said, I'm trying to take the gun off. Like, what do you think I'm doing? And then just like carried on with his activity. So the Israelis, they policed the West Bank for the entire Second Intifada, fighting against kids with stones who were trying to climb on their tanks and get closer to their tanks. A lot of this knowledge of how you can move around a tank was actually learned by children that were fighting in their communities, in their refugee camps, on a daily basis. And as they saw that, in fact, the closer you are to the tank, actually the safer you are, which is what the kids would explain to me over the first few days in the field to keep me alive, essentially, is that in that space around the tank has the least capability in that close distance. So that fighter could have used, in that Gaza City example, he could have used a Yassin RPG that we talked about. He could have positioned himself right behind the door and blasted it. But they decided on the ground that a more effective weapon would be to hand deliver what they call a Shawaz EFP and aim it at the back door of the tank, but not just aim it at the back door of the tank, place it on the tread at the back of the tank to disable the tank so that it cannot move. And then the possibility comes. Let's watch it one more time. From across the street, there's tanks all through the neighborhood. There's drones in the air constantly. He goes right for safety, which is, again, something that I'm not sure how much in Gaza they have experience. That kid that's planting that device, I don't think he was even old enough to know when there was tanks operating inside Gaza, but he operates safely, moving out of the way immediately. And then if we can see here, he's lying down on the ground. That's why they put the arrow there, because they want you to see that he's completing his mission to such a degree that he's lying down underneath the tank to place it. And that's a direct hit. And he goes back to the base.
That's him getting away.
And that's him getting away. Nice, good freeze frame there, Tamara. Yeah. That's him getting away from the blast. Green triangle for Hamas militant. And we'll talk more about this with Ali later on, because there's a video from today that talks about this. But this kind of that green arrow, you know, green for Hamas, like that, that kind of subtlety that they're putting into these videos, communicating with the world without saying a word, it's just really remarkable. But that green triangle is a really heroic moment. So social media was very, was awe-inspired by this. And couldn't believe that people would do this. But let's show Tamara from 2014, in the 2014 war, the Palestinian Nukba commandos, the elite frogmen, carried out an attack in July of 2014 on Zikim Beach that originally the Israelis said that they had repelled the attack by the frogmen who came from the sea in scuba gear up onto the shore. And so they come up onto the shore. If that video doesn't load, I can read the text from the description from the Israeli media. So this was the introduction to the world of Qassam's frogmen, the Nukba elite forces that became famous. So this is just north of the northwest corner of the Gaza Strip. And in July, the 2014 war, the 51-day war, the Israelis had said that these frogmen had attacked. You can see them here coming out of the water, carrying explosives out of the water, hiding in the berms here along the shoreline, and attempting to move up to an army base, which is on the corner, is on the coast in Zikim, just north of the border. And this base was overrun again on October 7th, and the soldiers and officers in the base were killed. So this attack in July, the Israelis told the world it was repelled. And then in December, this video was released. And you could see the fighters moving up. This is an Israeli camera. That's them moving across the road. And a tank shows up. The description of the video says the video opens with a military map looking at the code names of the locations and the surveillance cameras. So this is leaked from the Israelis. You can see the fighters there coming from the sea, moving through those berms and attacking a military base. They had to stop in the weeds there and take off their flippers and their wetsuits and to get into their gear. They're under fire there. You can see the fire all around them there, but they make it through. And now you can see in that video, they're up on the berm beside the road, preparing their devices. They're throwing grenades up on the road. And here comes the tank to try to get them. Again, we've taken the audio out so that we don't get these videos taken down. The same reason we describe them as jelly beans, just in the hopes that these videos won't get taken down.
And this was 2014.
This is 2014. This has happened before, is the point of this story. This unbelievable courage, when the resistance didn't have the same devices that they have now. So this is the description from the Israeli press. After the fighters cross the road and take cover in the depression in the sand, IDF forces engage them from the east. A Merkava tank and a bulldozer arrive as well. And one of the Qassam frogmen runs up to the tank and hangs explosives on it. And on the Israeli audio, they shout out in Hebrew, number two, he's on your tank. He's on your tank. Drive. Here he goes. He literally hangs it on the tank. That's the tank barrel that you see. Then he gets back. He goes back under cover there. And the tank, the explosive detonates. Having to swim with the explosive meant that they weren't able to bring a Shawaz with them. But look at them fighting right here, right in front of the tank, right from the berm. And so just wanted to show that to people, that this is before, this has happened before. This is part of a tactical, this is part of their tactical approach. Look at them fighting within the zone of the tank there. And of course getting hit by helicopters, because by this point they call in helicopter gunships, and they go back to the sea. After bombing the tank, they make it all the way across, Unfortunately, this operation did amount to a martyrdom mission, but just incredible courage that those fighters, and to repeat, those were frogmen that entered from the sea, came up underwater with explosives, made it all the way across this open space up to the base and attacked them. And then if we want to just show one more, Tamara, if we can just show the night after the footage of Gaza City hanging the Shawaz on the tank. Let's go to the footage from the IDF. The IDF released this. You can see there another guy right beside a tank hanging an explosive, attempting to hang an explosive on the side of the tank. This is IDF drone footage that they released to show that that they can use close air support. This is what the Israelis said. The way that close air support works with the ground forces. And you can see that they're showing a fighter right beside the tank attempting to hang explosives on it. And the Israeli response, of course, is not to dismount from their tank where they outnumber the fighters by a considerable margin. They also have escorts for those armored vehicles. So there could have been, as many as 25 soldiers descend on that area and fight, but they don't. They stay in the tank, they call in air support, and the Israeli video shows them blowing up half the neighborhood trying to find these two guys.
But the Israelis claim that they killed the Palestinian fighters, but I didn't see that in the video.
Yeah, I cut that out of the video because it's not clear that they cut the video. They spliced the video and showed them bombing from the air something. There's no connection to it being
correct.
Those fighters.
That's what I mean. Even the full version that the Israeli army released doesn't show definitively that they hit those two brave fighters.
And that's the closest that we get to seeing Palestinian fighters in Israeli videos. But look at that. He's right up beside the tank doing the same thing. So it's not just one guy who's impassioned or maybe particularly angry or has some particular level of courage. This is a fighting force that's prepared to fight this type of war. And that's one of the tactics that they're using.
These tactics, John, we've seen it in video after video after video, whether it's the Shawaz bombs that they're using, like the explosively formed penetrators, whether it's the RPGs, the Yassin 105, as they call it, or whether it is the sniper rifle or landmines, explosives that they set in a fixed position and then detonate, there's a consistency that indicates a very high level of training and consistent training across the board. Because, as you say, it's not just one or two individual, but video after video. And I think we're going to see some RPG rockets in some of the upcoming videos. But I've been reading about these RPGs, John, and they're incredible weapons invented by the Soviet Union, perfected by the Soviet Union, and then made in a number of countries. The point is, they are simple, they're available, but it still takes an enormous amount of skill to use them.
Actually, that's even better than that, Ali. They took those two weapons from the Soviet Union, the RPG-2 and the RPG-7, and they reverse engineered them and joined them into one weapon so that they could get the benefits of the one and the benefits of the other, one being simple and one being the ability to mass produce them. And then the Palestinians themselves are manufacturing these in small underground facilities, and they've clearly been at this for the last, the Yassin program itself. The Yassin program started in 2003, so it's a 19-year-old weapons program. Is that right? 20? What year is it? 20-year-old weapons program. We've seen the Al Ghul sniper rifle that we're going to talk about later. That's an 11-year project. The Qassam rockets, those began just after the beginning of the Second Intifada in 2000, 2001. So the rocket program is 22 23 years old. And so you see a consistent dedication to this fight that's happening right now. This is not a makeshift response. This defense of Gaza has been planned for decades, and now they actually have the capacity, the manufacturing capacity, to enable an army to fight back and defend their communities in such a way that Israel is already saying, they're already starting to leak out, okay, we're not going to defeat Hamas totally. You know, starting to calibrate a little bit of those, we're going to wipe out Hamas and then de-radicalize the Gaza Strip after making everybody orphans and driving them out of their houses. You know, this kind of ridiculous talk that we had to deal with for weeks of this war, that's just clearly not true. The Palestinians are able to fight this battle, and they waited until the point in the struggle that they could fight that battle. Because what we're seeing with all of this materiel that they've created is that they could have perhaps fought a smaller scale battle at previous times in the last number of years, and clearly chose not to until they were ready and prepared. And during that time, they're training their fighters consistently every day. And we've seen that because of October 7th. Some of the Israeli intelligence people talk about how they were watching them train in the open air in Gaza for years before the attack, and all the way down to watching them train by breaching make mock-ups of the wall itself. So they've been training. They trained their fighters to fire the RPG. They built the RPGs themselves to handle the warheads that are reverse engineered. So they find something like a Soviet weapon that is useful, simple, you know, like the AK-47, doesn't break down like Western weapons often do, doesn't jam. Everybody can use them, and then distributed those to trained fighters in large numbers. And that's what's made this battle for Israel, you know, Israel was, I'm sure, expecting to just fight for a couple months and then withdraw. But they have absolutely nothing to show for the fight other than the massacre of civilians. And so now they're in a place where they're trying to talk about a next phase of the war where it's going to be perhaps slightly less intense. But they're not talking about an end game to the fight with Qassam, because Qassam is more capable today, and we can see it from their resistance reports, that they're more capable of fighting today than at any point. And so let's move to the second section here, and we're going to talk about this concept that the IDF proposed last week to its people in Hebrew. You talked about it, Ali, that they had complete operational control. That was the word that they used in Hebrew, complete operational control.
Absolute operational control.
Even stronger word.
Absolute operation control.
So, yeah. So, and then we watched these videos from Shujai and Jabalia. Those were the two areas that they said they had absolute operational control. These are the two, and this is Saraya al-Quds, so this is not Qassam, this is Islamic Jihad. Walking, we talked about them walking through walls. This is them walking through buildings from neighboring buildings, climbing through the buildings, which is something that they know because they live in this neighborhood. And one of the things about the Islamic Jihad videos is that they, the Saraya al-Quds is the name of their armed wing, they follow a little longer with their shots. And so you can actually see these guys navigating between the alley.
Surprised he's not barefoot, though.
To get into position to create a sniper's position. So at this point, nobody's been in a window because they came in through the back of the house. That the fact that they have an entire unit of soldiers looking at these buildings, the sniper is able to bring his Dragunov rifle into position without ever going to a window and picks them off one by one. And that's the kind of fight that you see when you don't
is
have
that a
operational
single shot right. rifle, John. Is that that sniper?
Yeah.
It is
yeah.
a single. So, but what's interesting, because you point out they do not go right up to the window. The Saraya al-Quds fighters, so the Al-Quds, of course, being the military wing of Islamic Jihad, the equivalent of as Qassam is to Hamas, Saray al-Quds is to Palestinian Islamic Jihad. But what we often see, I think we'll see this in some of the other videos, is the Israelis sit right in the window.
And that's because well, it's like they've never been trained before.
Yeah,
they move in a group. Yeah. They're used to having stones themselves. Thrown. Right. No, that's it. Yeah.
They're used to having stones. Sorry to interrupt you, Nora. They're used to having stones thrown at them by kids. They're used to shooting people who didn't have anything to do with it on the street. They're not ready for a trained force that's been studying, not only just practicing, but also studying the theory of fighting and what you're trying to achieve. And look at passing the weapons through this alleyway, climbing over the alley, and showing this as like whatever the opposite of absolute operational control is when you have fighters climbing through the buildings in order to get better shots at your soldiers. So what we're seeing is Palestinians with absolute operational control over these neighborhoods and moving through the walls in these ways.
Walking through the walls,
which the Israelis in 2002, their postmodern philosopher department made this thing like in the battle of the 2002 battles, that they were really pinned down in the places like the old city of Nablus or in Jenin. And so these IDF philosophers said, you know, like maybe we need to look at things differently. We don't need to look at a house as a house or a wall as a wall. They said we can reinvent the architecture. That was their terminology. We can reimagine the architecture. And they were saying, you know, we would blow through the walls and do all these things that Palestinians have already done and don't have postmodern philosophers describing. But reimagining the landscape was the way the Israelis talked about it. And I don't know how much more reimagining you could do than this kind of movement through that area. And so is there, I'm not sure if we have the second one from Shajaiya, but we have one from today, we have Jabalia. So this is Jabalia. They're able to fight in Jabalia with absolute operational control. They don't even have operational control over the building next door to them. And this is a force getting hit by a thermobaric grenade. And this is a shot of their tank being dragged away from Jabalia, where they say they have operational control, and they're being hit literally from the next building and dragging their gear away. And so that's Jabalia.
And last time we did see the other footage of them having to tow disabled tanks out of I don't remember which neighborhood it was in, but you know, this is now presumably a common scene of them having to tow their junk out of Gaza.
And see, he hits that window. He hits that window from next door. So again, they're not only putting themselves in position to do this, but they're also, they have military acumen when it comes down to the moment. They're hitting their shot. They're pointing at the window they're aiming at, and they're hitting the shot. And if anything, they're better at it now as the war has gone on, because these fighters are learning incredible amounts that you could never train for. This is the kind of stuff that you learn in battle. This is in the broader picture. This is the kind of stuff that makes it really hard to see going back to a world before October 7th, because you not only have the hundreds of orphaned children in Gaza, people who have watched this horror happen in front of them, but you also have tens of thousands, literally, of skilled fighters who now have been fighting for 55 days of a ground war. And what happens the day that that's over? Is the implication that without a prisoner exchange or without some kind of a trajectory for a just peace for Palestinians, that these tens of thousands of fighters are going to accept not fighting for an indefinite period of time when their people are being attacked all over, like they're being attacked in Jenin today. And Jenin doesn't have, the West Bank doesn't have the weapons capacity or the training that the Gaza Strip has been allowed since 2005, when the Palestinian resistance drove the Israelis out of Gaza in 2005 and allowed for the development of this weapons industry that had begun before, but after 2005 can really become entrenched. The tunnel network becomes entrenched. I mean, we're on day 80 something now. We haven't even really talked about the tunnels because they haven't, right. The Israelis haven't even begun that process. There's an entire architecture underneath the ground that the Israelis call the metro because it's as big as some metropolis subway stations, subway networks. They haven't even touched that. They're fighting on the outside levels against guerrilla tactics using weapons that everybody in the world has.
John,
admittedly,
it strikes yeah. me though that we're looking at something. I mean, you tell me if I'm wrong, but we've seen conventional war in, you know, in different places in the world, and we've seen guerrilla war. That I've seen a lot of comparisons between the tactics of the Palestinian resistance and the Viet Cong, and that's probably one of the very close parallels, including the tunnel network and the ability to move like ghosts, basically. The Americans, too, used to talk about we're fighting ghosts in Vietnam. They could never see them coming, and yet they were able to inflict severe pain on the vastly equipped American invaders who, despite dropping literally millions of tons of bombs on Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos, were unable to defeat the resistance there. But I wonder, listening to you and watching these videos, if we're seeing something new here, because Qassam, or the Palestinian resistance, not just Qassam, but that being the main, the largest group, presumably, are organized in a sense like a state, like a conventional army, in terms of their order of battle, the fact that they have different brigades and divisions that cover different parts of Gaza, the fact that there is standardization of their weapon systems, of their training. Presumably, they have very effective command and control because we can see that they are maintaining that up to this minute. So they have a lot of aspects or characteristics of a conventional army, a conventional military, but they fight like guerrillas. Is there anything to that, or is that also true of past guerrilla armies?
I mean, I think that to find an example of a war like this, where you have an entrenched, dug-in population that prepared for the fight for this long. I mean, the Israelis are very quick to say that there's no analogy to it, because even the way that the tunnels were used in Vietnam was a lot more defensive. Defensive tunnels. You can read in the Israeli field reports, they're talking about 9 men ambushes from 3 separate tunnels on one unit. So Palestinians are using 3 separate attack tunnels to carry out a single ambush of the Israelis. And they're getting back and reporting on this because there's no way for them to advance and clear any kind of territory. And that's what the Americans ultimately were doing in Vietnam, was they just completely, they napalmed the villages, completely destroyed everything that was on the top, and then gassed underneath the tunnels. We're not sure yet. We don't know if the Palestinians have continuity, contiguity between the tunnel networks. Does Gaza City connect to Khan Yunis? We don't know that, and the Israelis don't know that yet. Either. Yeah. But yes, the structure of the force has been created as, a hybrid army, as set up as an army with, like you said, set up separate divisions, separate commands in each area. And we know from the fight that's been happening that these commanders have been in charge of these positions for years, decades in some cases, some of these commanders. So they're not constantly promoted up a chain to become, cushy bosses. They're battalion commanders on the ground in these areas that are leading this area. Wissam Farhat was leading the Shuja'iyah battalion before he was assassinated. He was leading it consistently for 14 years. Same with Ahmed Gandour, who was the northern commander for Qassam, who was killed. The Israelis have been trying to kill him since 2002. They had five different attempts at him. You know, they talk about nine different attempts at Mohammed Deif, the commander of the Qassam brigades. So they've been trying to get these guys for a long time, but they have had the ability to stay within their units, training those forces to fight contiguously within these, so between Shuja'iyah and Jabalia, which are side by side, and for the Israelis to tell their people that they have operational control over Shuja'iyah and Jabalia, is that's them telling their people the two places that they know in Gaza, because they got smoked there in the past. The first intifada started in Jabalia, and of course, like, if you were to ask Rafat about the battle of Shuja'iyah, if you, you know, said, what do you remember about the battle of Shuja'iyah? Rafat would say, which battle of Shuja'iyah, right? Because there was a battle of Shuja'iyah in 1987. There was a battle of Shuja'iyah in 2014 that the Israelis are still have ghosts of. And now the most fierce fighting in this war has been in Jabalia and Shuja'iyah. Shuja'iyah is where the Golani Brigade experienced their commander team, as they call it, a team of commanders who got triple ambushed. They got ambushed in a building. They called for reinforcements. The commander's team sent in reinforcements. They got hit too. So now it's a double ambush. And Israelis report on the communications coming between those ambushed and calling out to the APCs that we see the guys not outside of the armored vehicles, calling to the armored vehicles saying, get out of your vehicles and come in and help us. And they came in and helped them and they got smoked too. So triple ambushes, that killed nine from the Golani Brigade just in that few minutes. Two senior commanders, a lieutenant colonel and a colonel, two of the most senior commanders to be killed in battle in Israel in 50 years. And so they're saying you have operational control over this area. Of course, Shuja'iyah is also where they massacred their own absolute operational
operational control. But that reminds me also just two things that I listened to over the weekend. One was an interview. This was on an Indian YouTube channel of all things, somewhat pro-Israeli from the sense I got, but it was an interview with Ephraim Halevi, the former head of the Mossad, and he said very bluntly in that interview that Israel completely underestimated the fighting capabilities of the Palestinian resistance, and he also said that he didn't think Israel would succeed in its goals in this war. That's the former head of the Mossad, Israel's notorious spy agency. And also Dan Halutz, the former Israeli army chief of staff, who was the chief of staff, I believe, during the war with Lebanon, the last war with Lebanon, also said that Israel would not win this war.
And he was the one who declared victory in Lebanon like 2 days into the war.
Right. And we all know what happened next. And for those who don't, Israel lost. But
and just one more thing about when you were saying Vietnam, Ali, because, yeah, they are starting to say that they're losing. And in Vietnam, when the Americans were losing, when their commanders would tell them to go patrol in the elephant grass, and the fighters, the American fighters, said, no way, it's too dangerous. We don't want to do these operations. The guerrillas just kill us anytime we go into these areas, which is the equivalent of getting out of your tanks in Israeli vernacular. That gave rise to this concept called fragging, where the fighters of their own force would grenade their commanders. And basically what they would do is they would put a grenade in their tent at night with a pin in it that said, you know, if you send us into the elephant grass one more time, this pin will be taken out of the grenade. And that kind of discord within the force made it very difficult for the Americans to fight. Yesterday, the Golani brigade removed a company commander who told his fighters to go into a house. And they said, I'm not going into that house because of the booby traps that we've seen everywhere. And there was a battle, a fight between the commander, the company commander, and his soldiers about going into this house. And the Israeli army sided with the soldiers who were too scared to go into the house. And so, yeah, you could see these kind of things, that these ambushes are in the heads of Israeli soldiers.
Yeah.
And the complexity of the ambushes that we've seen in these videos, we could show these videos. We could have a 4-hour show just showing videos, the detailed ambushes setting up Israeli soldiers.
Let's show some more, John.
Yeah, so let's show today. So this is from today, guys.
We get through the ones we have in the time we have left.
Yeah, this one came out just before we started our live stream. So yeah, set this up for us, John.
Yeah, well, I actually haven't seen this because we were just about to go on.
I watched it once. I usually like to watch them repeatedly.
So that's an elevated firing position hitting that tank. That clearly is a hit. And again, we're seeing Yassins that were built by Gazans. Every weapon we're seeing is built in Gaza.
And the Yassin, again, this is basically a modified reverse engineered RPG-7. And the point about the RPG-7, we should pause it there for a second. Yeah, let's pause that if we can. We'll come back to this. But the thing about the RPG-7 is that if you're using it at a very long range, the Israelis can defend against it. Their trophy system or whatever it is can kick in. But again, it's the courage of the fighters that they're getting within the close range that this very simple weapon, I mean, well-designed weapon, but relatively simple and available.
And light
is able to defeat a multi-million dollar Merkava tank because of the willingness of the fighters to get that up close and personal. And this appears to be, I'm not exactly sure what we're looking at. Is this a blackboard or a piece of armor? I'm not sure exactly, but they say, Kata'ib al-Qassam, Tufan al-Aqsa, which is so the Qassam brigades, and then Tufan al-Aqsa, the name of the operation, al-Aqsa flood. And they say, Tam tadbir thalath aliyat, where I think it says Dababa, it's not very clear. Well, Ishtibak ma'ajunud fi hadha al. Can't quite see the last word on my screen. It's very small, maybe in this place. But the point is they are, I don't know if this is a reference to the Israelis when they write on the blackboards in the school they occupy, or whether this was their just way of answering back, or if this is written on a piece of destroyed Israeli armor. But they also use the hashtag Tufan al-Aqsa. So it, to me, this shows how connected these Qassam fighters in the field are to the audience that they are speaking to with these videos, and that they're even thinking about that when they're in the field, which is just absolutely incredible.
And Tamara says that the last word that is kind of blurry says al-bayt, from this house.
Yeah, that, I see that now. I'm in Hadal Bayt.
So this is in Shijair. Are they saying that that's the house that hit the APC? Because that's where the burning APC was. We'll sort that out and get it to you for next show, guys, because we're watching this live ourselves. So.
And there you get secondary explosions, if I'm correct, which is always a nice way of knowing that they set something big off.
Yeah, so the thing about the RPG-7 models is that they're light and you can carry them and you can move deftly with them rather than guided anti-tank weapons.
And here we have some guys who are, you know, doing the classic Israeli thing of being in the window.
Yeah. I've been calling them on my Twitter feed. They're a separate kind of video called Soldier in a Window, which is just a totally absurd thing. And it's still happening. But when we get to the next section, we'll see they've made some additions to this. Again, so they're saying they have total, what was it?
Standing absolute in a group
operational
again.
Control, and they're standing in a group inside a house because I guess
maybe they think they have control.
They've been told, yeah.
And then this, just pause it for a second. They say, "Maqtal wa isabat 10 min junud wa dubbat al-adu ithra istihdafihim bi qadhifat mudada lil-afrad." So they say the killing and injuring of 10 enemy soldiers when they were hit with an anti-personnel weapon, anti-personnel grenade or rocket.
Right. So the RPG-7 has multiple warheads that it fires, and the Palestinians have made ones. They've made a thermobaric one, which is for buildings. That is a fuel explosion warhead. We've seen the Yassin 105 is the tandem charge one that we described on an earlier show where it explodes twice to try to get around the reactive armor that's on the tanks or even through the trophy system in the tanks. And they also have a fragmentation grenade which explodes and creates fragments that are, so that would be the anti-personnel one.
We have another video, the house with the curtains.
More windows. So this is the attempt by the Israelis here. So they're describing that what you're seeing is the thermobaric one. They're painted that tan color. So we see the introduction of curtains, and then you see they've pointed out that sniper hole, and you can see the snipers in those window positions. And they've added curtains because they never had curtains before. So now they're trying to protect themselves with curtains, which just tells everybody that they're in that room. And now they're not in that room. And that is, again, these are casualties. That's a thermobaric grenade. What you're seeing is a fuel explosion going off inside that building.
And that little caption they added said, soldier burning. So
they don't get out of that. They don't get out of that scene. And then at the end of this clip, they show captured weaponry when they've gone up to that building. Again, saying they have absolute operational control. They don't even have it over a building. And you can see their weapons.
Weapons are badly burned. You can
badly
see
burned. From, yeah, melted, so, even though they're metal weapons. Actually, I think that might be a sniper rifle with a tripod, but the one above it is that's a small machine gun there. Mm.
Yeah.
Light machine gun. So yeah, you can see on those that they're burnt and warped.
Do the three red triangles there mean that they're saying that was three kills? Is that?
I think that they're saying the three different weapons, but yeah, there's at least three in that window that they put triangles for.
Yeah.
So there's three fighters' guns. One had a sniper rifle with a tripod. One was working the belt-fed light machine gun that you see there. And then the bottom one is just the standard issue M4.
Do we know where that was?
That's a good image there of the RPG. I'm sorry, Nora.
No.
They say at the beginning, I don't remember what this location.
This is the rest of the Gaza City video.
Okay.
This is the video, the same video that starts with the Shawaz heroism, finishes with this. So this is in one video, they show us presumably multiple kills inside the tank. This is at least three in this building here.
Go back to that image.
See that triangle?
Just pause it there with the guy. Yeah, just because this is such a good shot of the RPG rocket that this is the so-called tandem. You can see, John, I've been studying. Not trying to compete with you, but just because I like to understand what we're looking at.
That's the same shaped warhead as the 105 that they fire at the tanks, but they fill it with fuel, so it's the same casing, and that's why it's the same size in the same casing, just for ease of production.
Yeah, but this is also typically the shape of the anti-tank warhead, where you've got the smaller bulge at the tip, which is the smaller charge, which defeats the arm, the reactive armor, the so-called reactive armor. Some of these tanks have, you can see that they sometimes have these boxes hanging off them that actually explode. It's a little bit like the airbag in your car. How does the airbag work when, if heaven forbid you get in an accident, the airbag explodes and it pushes you back so that you don't go, you know, it counteracts the force. And the reactive armor does the same. It's an explosion that counteracts the incoming warhead. So the first little charge on that at the tip defeats the reactive armor. And then the second bigger bulge contains, and this is also, John, is this also an explosively shaped penetrator? It also creates a jet of molten metal that goes through the armor and can get through very thick armor. There's actually something called the Tank Museum, which is in the UK, which does these educational videos, and they have one about the RPG, which is really interesting and explains how this, because, you know, people look at this with disbelief and they say, how can this very dinky looking weapon get through the armor of a Merkava tank or an Abrams tank? And that's how this is why I needed to go in depth into this, because I wanted to understand, is what I'm seeing real? Can this weapon really penetrate through, you know, dozens of centimeters of armor? And the answer is yes, it can.
Hundreds, yeah.
Especially if it is used at close range. And the close range is the thing that we see time and again in this video, because of the willingness of these fighters to risk their lives and get up close to those tanks. So that was my own little John impression on the RPG.
No, all good stuff. I actually think that the seeing the thermobaric grenade in the same kit, or like in the same as the Yassin 105, I believe is just for ease in production, that they have the molded casting already for that, and so they're using it in multiple ways, which is just ingenious. And if you had your own weapons manufacturing industry that wasn't underground or being attacked, you might form those differently, because a thermobaric grenade that was made by the Russians doesn't have that double tip. It just has one sort of like flare out of it. So I believe that what we're seeing, and again, we're going to have to wait for the documentaries, because we don't have the weapon specs on these kind of things. People are trying to put it together in real time. People in the comments say it doesn't work, but no soldier says it doesn't work. The soldiers, especially people that fought in Iraq, know that the tandem charged warheads definitely penetrate armor, and the Shawaz for sure. The Shawaz penetrates up to 65 centimeters, 650 millimeters of armor, which is the Israelis' armor depth, size of their armor on their tanks is classified, but it's in the order of, you know, between 250 millimeters and 600 millimeters. But in various spots. So if you hit the right
spot, you don't need to destroy the tank completely.
No, you just need to pierce the armor.
You just need to, or you just need to destroy the treads. And the thing is a 70 ton piece of junk.
Mm-hmm. So when they went in on October 7th, the Palestinians, Qassam, gave their fighters a little cue card that showed the spots on the tanks to hit. And it's one, if you can, you hit the door. But then there's a second one, and for sure, and disabling the tread of the tank when you're Israeli and you're deep inside Shujaiya, where you claim operational control, and you lose the tread on your tank and need an evacuation, it's significant. So there's different ways to target the vehicles that are more than just destroying the entire thing. And even still, like when you talk about piercing armor, all that has to make it through is one tiny little piece of hot metal. And that's effectively a bullet inside of your tank that it can't leave, because the piece is, once it cools, it can't exit the vehicle. So it bounces around inside the vehicle, and it's just a hellscape inside. And the soldiers are terrified of that. And that's why the Israelis build their tanks so thick, because the soldiers know it's terrible. And the Americans had to go through that in Iraq because they have crappier armor. That's what they talked about too. Roadside bombs go off and just leave pieces of shrapnel flying around inside this tiny metal casing that you're in. And so they're not even safe in their tanks, but when they're under attack like that, they're definitely not getting out of their tanks. And that's why the Palestinians see that they're not getting out of their tanks, and then they are placing a Shawaz device because it's a more effective weapon than, they're choosing their tactics in the moment. And that's the thing about a guerrilla war. When the troops are in more fixed positions for longer, the resistance has the ability to think about how to attack and plan and tactically approach that objective. They're able to use their tunnels and figure out where in the tunnel network they could best come up to ambush. So all of these things are all intensifying as the war goes on. So they're not degrading the capability of the resistance. The resistance is more able to fight every day. The only thing that Israel's degrading is hospitals. They're destroying hospitals, parliament buildings, bakeries. They're not fighting the resistance. And we see on video opportunities to fight the resistance that they're passing.
We've talked about the Dahiya Doctrine before. The Dahiya Doctrine, which was invented by, Gadi Eisenkot, who was the chief of staff and whose son was killed in Gaza in the last 2 weeks. Dahiya, of course, is a reference to the southern suburb of Beirut, where the doctrine, the so-called Dahiya Doctrine, is you attack the civilians, you destroy this infrastructure. Why? Because what's the motivation for that? It's because Israel could not fight and defeat Hezbollah. So the idea was, make their civilians pay the price, make it so painful that they won't dare to go to war with us. So the Israeli strategy of massacring civilians, of bombing hospitals, of destroying housing, of inflicting this horrific suffering, the kind of humiliation we're seeing of people where they're taking men and boys and children and stripping them down to their underwear and humiliating them, is because Israel cannot fight soldier to soldier. They are the classic bully that goes after the people they perceive as weaker than them, which is not the Qassam fighters, not the Sarai al-Quds fighters. It's the civilian men, the elderly men, the women, the children, the doctors, the hospitals, and so on. This is why Israel goes after them. If Israel could fight the Qassam fighters, if they could defeat them, they would. They can't.
Yeah, those videos of the mass arrests are awful. But just to say to that, everybody has their head up in those videos. Everybody's shoulders are back. People are defiant in those videos as well. And so I don't even think the Dahiya Doctrine works. This idea that you just make the price so heavy that people won't resist. I think you're getting the exact opposite.
It's such a racist idea, John, because think of the mythology of the Blitz, of London under the Nazi bombs, or Coventry under the Nazi bombs, where people talk about, they still talk about this today. They talk about the Blitz, the spirit of the Blitz. Did the Nazi bombing of London and Coventry and the killing of thousands of civilians, did it make British people say, oh, we should give up and become Nazis? We should give up and join Hitler? No, they still take pride in the idea that, oh, that we stood up, we stood together, we did what it takes. We went down to the London Underground, to the Tube, to shelter and so on. Queen Elizabeth, Your late queen, John, you know, drove a truck during the Blitz. And this is all part of the mythology in which, you know, British people are strengthened by adversity. But Palestinians or Iraqis or whoever else it is that the Americans are bombing with, you know, their British and other European tails wagging behind will be broken, will give up, will surrender. And what we're seeing, you know, for all the horrific pain and suffering that we're seeing from Gaza and that we're hearing from our friends and colleagues in Gaza who are telling us about the most awful things that you can, I mean, things that the worst horror film cannot match. I mean, one of our friends, I didn't say to him that I was going to mention his comments in public, so I won't his name. But one of our colleagues in Gaza wrote to us this morning that there had been a bombing of right next door to his family's home. Luckily, his family has survived, but their house was badly damaged, and he said, it was filled, this is the thing that I can't get out of my head, it was filled with body parts from the neighbors. Their house was filled with, so they survived, but their house was filled with body parts from their neighbors. These are the horrors that Israel is inflicting on people in Gaza, inflicting unbearable suffering. And there isn't a single person in Gaza that says, we want this to continue for another. But there also are not anyone I've seen who's saying we're ready to surrender to this enemy.
Right. No, never. No. No. Let's talk about the, I know you wanted to say something about the Al Ghul sniper rifles, John, and why that's significant, what we're seeing in these jelly beans about the Al Ghuls.
Right. So we have seen, and we showed last episode, the factory that manufactured the Al Ghul sniper rifle, a 50 caliber sniper rifle, that again is a reverse engineered version of the of an Austrian weapon. And so here we're seeing snipers. You can see in this video, you can see the binoculars shine because they don't have the binoculars covered. So they're exposing themselves in these positions and are being hit by that's the afterwards. So the snipers were in that position and using an Al Ghul sniper rifle, they're able to pick out those particular soldiers. And the weapon, and just sort of to bring this whole thing full circle, the weapon, the Al Ghul, is named after Adnan Al Ghul. And he is the Qassam commander who really, they call him the father of the arms industry, but he was the one who said that more than just get, he was a weapons collector. His story, maybe we'll have more time to delve into his backstory future shows. But suffice it to say, it's incredible and includes before he was on Israel's most wanted list, before the First Intifada. So before Qassam even existed, before Israel knew that Qassam existed, Adnan Al Ghul was on their most wanted list. In September 1987, he killed the IDF military police chief in Gaza when Israel was inside Gaza. And that's an important position in military police during the occupation. So they killed the number one occupation soldier. He killed the number one occupation soldier, and then he killed the Shabak, the Shin Bet, the Israeli internal security chief in Gaza as well. And he goes on the lam and leaves Gaza by sea, ultimately coming back after the end of the First Intifada, because there's a manhunt for him in Israel for years. And he ends up getting back to Gaza by swimming back into Gaza, carrying a barrel, which is one way that Palestinians used to smuggle weaponry into Gaza, was through barrels from Egypt. And you float the barrel, sometimes using the current. But in this case, he used it swimming and brought back TNT from abroad, and basically gets to work with the Qassam brigades, with Yahya Ayash, who's the Qassam bomb maker, gets to work making making an arms industry within the Gaza Strip. When the Second Intifada breaks out, Adnan al-Ghul is the one who's told to, who's the one who tells people that we need to arm our fighters, and we need to arm them with weaponry that we can make, not just that we can capture. And so he begins the sort of large scale industrial production of things like homemade weapons, like homemade pipe bombs. He begins the Qassam rocket program, which at the time in 2000 was just to fire on the settlements inside Gaza. So the distance was like hundreds of feet at first. And now we're at hundreds of kilometers, 20 something years later. So Adnan al-Ghul has this sniper rifle named after him. And it's a nod, which is what Qassam does with all of their weapons. It's a nod. Each of their weapons are named after, like the Yassin is named after Ahmed Yassin, the founder. Some people have wondered if it was named after the massacre, Deir Yassin, from the 1948 war. But it's named after the fighters, the fighters that were in the group, like Abdulaziz Rantizi. That's the name of their long-range missile, the R-85. R90, I believe they got additional kilometers out of it. So these are long range rockets now out of a program when in 2000 they were firing them hundreds of feet in order to just get them into the settlements to harass the Israelis. And so in this period of time, in this one generation, they go from having rockets that barely travel to an entire rocket program that would getting to what Ali said, the Israelis believed that there was 1,300 rocket tunnel exits, like buried rocket launchers in the ground. And in an article in Yedio Aronot in Hebrew yesterday, the Israelis were saying that they were off by 600% the number of launchers that the Palestinians have. And we can see them firing these rockets from in the ground. And that's why the Israelis can't hit them, because they fire and then they go back down into the ground and the Israelis can't stop them, can't knock them out. They can't even find them in a lot of cases. They've shown some videos where they actually like physically stumbled across rocket launchers. But there's nothing in the scale of what the Palestinians have to fight with. So that's why 80 plus days in, the Palestinians are still able to fire rockets on Tel Aviv so that Israeli ministers are meeting in bomb shelters in the Knesset. And that's still happening. There doesn't seem to be any indication that any of these weapons are in short supply. We don't see in any of these videos where Palestinians are making a choice to choose between weapons because there maybe isn't enough of the other weapons. So it looks to be, I think, what we predicted on this show on October the 9th. The Israelis can't win this war for a variety of reasons. One of them is Palestinian preparation and military acumen. One of them is that the population has been besieged for their entire lives, and they're not willing to just surrender. As Ali said, they're not willing to surrender if it means that or even have a ceasefire, if it means that the blockade doesn't end. And it means that the day after the war, they go back to being a besieged people with no rights, who can't travel to go to university, you know, or any normal thing that people in the world engage in, that Gaza has been prevented because they were warehoused into a ghetto and told to be quiet. And for many years, they were. And now they're not. And Israel has to make up the stories that started this program in order to justify a genocide, because on the face of it, the resistance is heroic. The Palestinian civilians, the courage of the civilians to deal with this, the scale of this horror, you know, it's greater than Israel can defeat. It's not the kind of war that you can win. And no matter how long they take, they're saying it'll take months. in months, they still won't win this war.
And one aspect we haven't talked about at all, and I'm just going to mention, but we do hope to devote a show to this, is the economic aspect. We're talking about the attrition in the military aspect in terms of all these casualties, Israel's hospitals filling up with wounded soldiers, and the high number of deaths. And as we've spoken about before, even the announced number of deaths and casualties is high and is unsustainable for Israel. But that's if we assume that they're telling the truth, and there's good reason to believe they're hiding a lot of the casualties given the strict military censorship. But the economic aspect of this unsustainability, the fact that you have hundreds of thousands of reservists who are taken out of the civilian economy, Israel has to pay them. There is a lot of unrest among the reservists because the Israeli military logistics are not up to scratch in terms of making sure they have decent housing and food and all of that kind of thing while they're sitting there on the perimeter of Gaza or up near the border in Lebanon. Of course, you have hundreds of thousands of Israelis, perhaps up to 300,000, who have been displaced from their homes, particularly in the north, all along the border, and also from all of the settlements in the south, like Kibbutz Be'eri, we spoke about, Sderot, Ofakim, and so on. And the fact that, economically speaking, foreign direct investment in Israel was already way down before the war because of the so-called anti-coup protests. You had all these venture capitalists. We talked about venture capitalists with Paul Bigar a couple of weeks ago. And tourism has collapsed completely. And Israel's even running out of ammunition. So there are all sorts of reasons why this war is unsustainable, but from Israel's perspective. But John, I want to ask you, that's all to lead up to this question. I mean, we can look at these videos and they show us pretty unbelievable scenes, but how do we know this is the big picture? How do we know we're not just comforting ourselves with these videos and saying, oh, well, you know, the resistance is doing great. Israel is still, after all, a massive army backed by the United States, whose aircraft carriers are just off the shore, that has sent more than 300 huge cargo loads of aircraft resupplying Israel with weapons. Isn't it just a matter of time before Israel grinds the resistance down and wins the war?
I mean, it doesn't appear to be the case. I mean, I think that the civilian toll is right now as a serious problem. And the Israelis believe that they can bomb the civilians into Qassam, giving back their prisoners. But Qassam is not going to do that. They're the most disciplined people with prisoners. And nobody knows that better than the Israelis. You know, they held Gilad Shalit for 2,000 days. And so the idea that you can win this war by just destroying the entire Gaza Strip, which is what they're doing, the resistance, even if the resistance were to stop fighting in order to regroup, which isn't happening, that's still big picture. It doesn't solve the situation for the Israelis that you have 2+ million people in the Gaza Strip who are now, devastated, lost everything. That that's not going to break their will to fight. It's going to increase their will to fight. And then on the Israeli side, you have to question whether after this war, which is they've admitted to 170 deaths at this point, and they've admitted to 5,400 soldiers. Incidentally, Yahya Sinwar apparently released a message, an internal message. It wasn't public, but he talked about 5,000. He said from his fighters that they've heard 5,000 Israeli casualties and 750 vehicles a hit. And the Israelis today released figures saying 5,400 injured soldiers injured since October 7th. So there, the two are, and the Israeli Ministry of Health, as I reported a couple weeks ago, said 10,000 soldiers and civilians have been treated in their hospitals, and that might include some double counting. But you're actually, from Yahya Sinwar and from the Israeli defense forces, are getting very similar numbers of casualties. And that doesn't even include, as the Israelis talked about, the psychological damage of their soldiers, the psychological damage of their settlers. Are they going to repopulate those villages in the north and the south? There's a lot of questions about the Palestinian ability to rebuild, but there's the same questions about Israel. Yes, they can get billions of dollars in support from the Americans, but they can't replace the hundreds of thousands of workers that they've lost. The Thai workers they've lost, they can't constantly fight wars like this and have legitimacy. The state's already lost its legitimacy in the international community, in much of the world, even with all the lies that they told that will eventually, most of the world, I think, will learn that those were lies. Israel has a legitimacy crisis of its own. So I would focus more on that than whether the besieged population can continue to resist, because history shows that they will. Like, that's like sort of saying, like, will that one slave revolt teach the slaves to not resist? It doesn't work like that. The next fight will be worse.
And one aspect also, again, this goes to the economic, but even before the war, again, we talked about the hundreds of thousands of people taken out of the civilian economy, displaced internally. So whatever businesses were operating in the north or in the southern settlements are not operating now or severely degraded. But in the summer, Israel had announced yet another initiative to fund, you know, funding with I don't know how many tens of millions of dollars, yet another initiative to try to stem the brain drain from Israel, which was an ongoing issue for years. They're always talking about their tech economy and their startups and that kind of thing. It's largely a myth, because any startup that really got going in Israel would often quickly move abroad. And certainly the workers would quickly move abroad. And so they were trying through these various initiatives to try to keep their most skilled, their most educated, their most productive workers in the country, and to stop them from seeking better, more secure lives abroad. And that was before the war. So what's it going to be afterwards? I think we're going to see an acceleration of that brain drain where many of the large number of Israelis, perhaps millions, who possess second passports or who have access to foreign citizenships through their parents or grandparents who can go back and get them, will leave. And even if they tell themselves, oh, it's just for a year or two or 3 years or whatever it is. In other words, the voluntary migration that Netanyahu is talking, so-called voluntary migration, because what it is genocide and ethnic cleansing, the real voluntary migration is among Israelis. So not only were they having a brain drain before the war, but also as of, I think it was June, they had the lowest number of incoming Jewish immigrants in years. I think it was some ridiculously low number for the year of, they'd managed to scrape up a couple of thousand desperate people who are willing to come to Israel. And that's why they saw, you know, there was almost jubilation in some quarters in Israel when the war in Ukraine escalated in February of 2022, because they're like, oh, how many Jews are in Ukraine who we can get to come to Israel? Well, they did get some, and from what I read, many of the Jews who went to Israel have now left, the Ukrainian Jews, because they say it's just too dangerous. So
I saw that story too.
Incredible.
They're not in a good position. And Israel themselves, they're saying they're fighting an existential war. And we'll have more time to cover it on future episodes, but it does look it looks like an existential war for them. It looks like a war of liberation for the Palestinians that has put the Palestinian cause at the center of the world's attention. And so I think we'll stay on it.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we wrap, do we want to do one last jelly bean for our fans out there?
Well, no, before we
unless,
do the
unless tomorrow we does, the, we can. That's it for us.
Okay, mm-hmm.
That's it. We no more jelly
we
beans.
We have no more.
We have so many.
Mar says there's one called Sniper on Sniper.
Okay, yeah, Sniper on Sniper. So this is the Palestinian snipers identifying. Again, this is the Al Ghuls. And you can see the soldier get hit there and take a tumble. Oh. He's down. And then you can see the binoculars. That's the sniper thinking he's being so secretive, but he hasn't covered his binoculars, and boom.
Cool.
So Sniper on Sniper is interesting because now you're seeing the two-way exchange between the Israelis and the Palestinians on the ground in these areas. So it's taking out snipers. And of course, also just to note for non-soldier people, that as you can imagine, snipers are something that are very psychologically devastating for soldiers. The idea that you could be shot at any moment from anywhere and you can't know where the people are is something American soldiers talked about all the time in Iraq. And this is far worse than that. And so I think that you can get the idea that this is going to become the type of war that the Israelis themselves aren't going to want to fight. But we won't get ahead of ourselves on that one.
Hmm. Well, before we wrap, Ali, did you want to say something to our, this is a new record for our viewers, over 3,000. Yeah.
Well, we're delighted to have so many new viewers. And just a reminder to people that the live stream is only part of what we do. As great as the live stream is, if I say so myself, we have so much amazing reporting and analysis at the website, at the Electronic Intifada. We have stories we're publishing every day, reporting on the ground from our colleagues in Gaza. We are so grateful to them. They are living through just indescribably horrible situations, but they are continuing to write. They are insisting on it. Mm-hmm. We've said before, many of them are students of our dear friend Rifat al-Arir, who was murdered and who left them with the mission of telling the story. And they say to us all the time, they say, we will not let Dr. Rifat down. And we're very proud to work with them. We're very proud to support them. We are so grateful to all of our viewers, our readers who share our work, who send the articles to friends and family. I've had emails from people who tell us that they print some of our articles out, written by some of our colleagues in Gaza, and hand them out at solidarity rallies and vigils and demonstrations, which is wonderful. All the ways that this information can be used to advocate. I've had emails from people who tell me that they're writing to their representatives or their MPs and sending articles or videos from EI, and that's also wonderful, or just sharing with friends and family. And do remember that all of this work is, we are independent, we are nonprofit, we are funded by viewers and readers who care about justice in Palestine as much as we do. So if you can, make a donation to support this work. There's a link on the website there. But if you want more options, in the description to this video, just down below, we have two separate donation platforms, one that has an option for credit card and PayPal, and one that has an option for credit card, Apple Pay, and you can use a U.S. bank account. And we're only asking now because it is December, it is the end of the year, and this is the time when we do raise most of the resources that we need throughout the year. But I think, Nora, is this our last live stream of the year?
I think so.
It's our last live live stream of the year. We're going to have more amazing stuff. So stay tuned for that. And we're going to come back in the new year. So I think this is my last live request for the year. Yeah. Support us if you can. If you can't make a donation, it's okay. Don't. This is a collective effort. So those who can, make a donation for yourself and on behalf of all the people around the world you're going to help educate by helping us to get this information out. And sign up for the mailing list. Very important. Right there. Get updates up at the top left of the website. And again, just because it is that time of year, I want to say again, thank you to all of our colleagues at the Electronic Intifada, those you see on the live stream, Tamara, who's behind the scenes, and those who are working hard right now, writing, editing, all of the amazing stuff we're publishing on the website. And as always, we keep in our prayers and in our thoughts all of our friends and colleagues in Gaza who, at every moment, we are thinking of you. We are working for you. We are shouting from the rooftops to stop the genocide, and we will continue to do that. Thank you, everyone. And yeah. wish everyone a happy new year, a peaceful new year, a new year of justice. It's a time of year where we feel reluctant to celebrate. Everything feels like it has that cloud over it because of the great sadness we feel over so much devastating loss. But there are things to celebrate. The resilience of people in Gaza, the resistance of Palestinians everywhere. And we celebrate the solidarity from all over the world, because ultimately those are the things that are going to bring liberation and victory to the Palestinian people.
Absolutely. And every day that we wake up is one day closer to that liberation day for Palestine. And I do also want to plug, on Friday, I believe, we're going to be premiering an extraordinary interview that Tamara just did with Abdeljawad Omar, who is a friend of the live stream. You've seen him many times here in this format. But Tamara sat down with Abdeljawad and talked about really the very intimate psychology of Zionism as a colonial project. And it's just an extraordinary interview. They talk about how the West is complicit and underpins every single move that the Zionist settler colony has ever made. They talk about the guilt of Europe and how that fuels the genocide in Palestine. And it's just remarkable. So I'm so excited that we're going to be premiering this, and it's going to be the first of many series that Tamara does for the podcast, and just extraordinary work on her part. Thank you all so much, Ali, John, Asa, traveling today, Tamara, of course, and all of our colleagues at the Electronic Intifada, Maureen, David, Michael, Leah, Omar, and all of us here. Thank you all so much, and we will be back to you next year.